So my name is Mike Coolin. I'm Pierre's graduate student. I'm from Santa Cruz. And I'm going to talk about the simulations I've been running about the first mini quasar. So no, hide this picture. OK, so the overview, I'm going to talk a little bit of some background and motivation for the simulations I've been running. Then I'm going to explain what kind of simulations I've run, and then show some analysis, but that's definitely still work in progress, and some conclusions and indications of what I want to do with this. OK, so the background. Just a quick reminder, this is basically the thermal history of the universe. So over here at the very left is a recombination, the origin of the CMB. So the temperature of the CMB, which is this red line, is falling off as 1 over 1 plus C after that. And the temperature of the IGM, the gas, is initially still coupled to the temperature of the photons because there's some residual electrons. But then around a redshift of 200 or 140 or so, it finally decouples and falls off as 1 over 1 plus C squared. So throughout the dark ages, this difference remains. And then at some point, the first sources turn on, and the gas is heated to around 10 to the 4 degrees Kelvin. And that's just sort of schematically shown here by this sharp increase in IGM temperature. But that whole process is not very well understood. And that's one of the areas I'm looking at with these simulations. So it's not clear. This, of course, is only the average temperature. So it's possible that some regions might be heated before others. And this whole process is just not very well understood. So then, of course, the temperature is interesting. But what we maybe really care about is the actual baryonic objects that are forming, that are collapsing. And so you can take this temperature and translate it into a criterion for baryonic collapse. So that's the genes criterion. So there's a genes mass. For masses below the genes mass, the baryons can't collapse because the gravity is not strong enough to overcome the pressure. And for masses above that, it is strong enough and baryonic structures form. So the genes length is given down here. And so you can convert that to a genes mass. And there's a sound speed dependence in here. So that's where you get temperature dependence. So you can just take this plot and convert it to genes mass, which is the red curve here. So at early times, it's around 10 to the 5, 10 to the 6 solar masses. It decreases slightly. And then at this reheating event, it shoots up and essentially makes it much harder for baryonic objects to form below that mass. OK, that's the background. Now, I wanted to say a few more words about the actual objects that are doing this reheating, or that's what my simulations are about. But first of all, there's these population 3 stars. So those are the very first stars that ever form. Those are the first luminous sources. So unlike the population 1 and 2 stars that we see around us today, which have metals, these ones don't have any metals. So they only have hydrogen and helium. And the difference is that, I mean, you need to somehow cool the temperature in order to decrease the genes mass. And it's easy to do that if you have metals, because they have a lot of electrons, and there's a lot of transitions, and it's easy to radiate away the energy. But if you don't have any metals, then you're stuck with kind of inefficient molecular hydrogen cooling. So it's very important to know how much molecular hydrogen you have around. And that lets you cool somewhat, but you can't fragment as far as you could if you have metals around. And so the thought is that you end up with more massive stars in these metal-free conditions. And this is borne out, some of this theoretical analytical considerations indicate this, but also this is borne out by numerical simulations, for example, by Abel and et al. And Brom et al. And others. And they show that these metal-free stars tend to have a mass distribution that is rather top-heavy. So it produces stars in the range of 100 to 1,000 solar masses, unlike today's stars, which are less massive. Tend to be less massive. Okay, and so, but we're not so much in this study, we're not so much interested in the stars themselves, but more in the remnants. And so this is some work that Hager and Woosley published in 2002, where they're considering here on the x-axis the initial solar mass of these stars, and on the y-axis the final solar mass, the remnant mass, basically. And I'm sort of interested in this range here, 50 solar mass upwards. And it's actually very nice. It separates into two regimes. Either your remnant is a black hole, or you don't have a remnant. And so the ranges are here, say, from like 50 to 160 solar masses or so. You form a black hole directly. You eject some material, but not very much. Mostly, you just form a black hole. And then there's a region where you have parent stability, so-called parent stability, where the temperatures in the final stages of a stellar evolution become so hot that you produce electron-positron pairs in abundance. And so that takes energy out of the internal gas energy and puts it into the rest mass of these particles. And you basically remove the pressure support. And then it collapses further, it gets even hotter, and just runs away. So this is the so-called parent stability. And here in this small region, you experience a lot of sort of parent stability pulsations, which remove the outer layers of the star. And so the remnant tends to be a little bit less. There's kind of a dip here. Then you enter a regime, the so-called parent stability supernova, where this whole process becomes kind of completely disrupts the star. So you end up with no remnant at all. And everything is just ejected out, and there's a large amount of nickel that's distributed. And these would probably be very interesting for very early on metal enrichment. Now, if you go even further, you still have this parent stability, but now the potential well is so deep and steep that you can't actually get any of the stuff out, and it falls back in, and it produces a black hole again. So you get black holes here, you get nothing here, and you get black holes again here. And then with the difference is that in this region, you don't really expel any metals or anything. And then there's also this regime here on the far right, which is sort of more speculative, the so-called supermassive stars. Hagen, Woosley, and others have considered, what if you had stars that are greater than 10,000 solar masses, for example? And, well, I certainly don't know too much about this, but there's been some work by Shapiro, although a different Shapiro, who showed that there's a general relativistic instability and that can cause these supermassive stars to collapse to black holes directly. And depending on their initial angular momentum, they might have an accretion disk around them or not. Those wouldn't actually really be stars. They don't actually start fusing elements in the center, but they still might produce a black hole. Okay, so now that we have made these black holes, we have to wonder what happens to them. So in some cases, you have a supernova explosion that accompanies the black hole formation. That's probably going to be violent enough to just completely unbind all the gas, because these are small halos. They have a very small escape velocity, only a few kilometers per second. And so it's easy to just eject all the gas from the halo. Now, in other situations, for example, these supermassive stars, you might not have an explosion, and you might not eject this gas. But if you do, if you unbind the gas, then after a while, the halo will continue to merge with other halos, and you will most likely replenish your gas supply. And then gas will start accreting onto this black hole, which is some artist rendering here by some people at NASA Goddard. We have a nice black hole and gas flowing onto it and radiating away. So this is basically a quasar. This is what Pierre and others have dubbed a mini quasar, because it's just a very small black hole. And this mini quasar is going to radiate mostly in high energy radiation, hard X-rays. Of course, it'll also radiate lower energy UV photons, but we're not going to be concerned with those. We're going to assume that those photons are going to be absorbed within the host halo. And only the hard X-rays can actually escape the host halo and affect the surrounding, I guess you would call it, proto-IGM. Now, the effects of these X-rays are that they're going to contribute to reionization to some extent. We'll have a few more words to say about that later. But also, they're going to heat the gas and thereby raise the genes mass. And then there's also an effect about what it does to molecular hydrogen. So there's sort of a debate. Some people say these X-ray photons would dissociate molecular hydrogen. Other people argue that there's a positive feedback effect that actually can create molecular hydrogen. But either way, you're going to possibly affect the molecular hydrogen, which will then inhibit or enhance further star formation. Okay, so yes. You want to graph it? Okay. So it depends on what regime you're talking about. How do I go back? So here you have a supernova explosion and then a black hole. Here you don't have a supernova explosion. In this range you would have a supernova explosion. And yes. So in a lot of the cases, actually the case I'm simulating, I'm looking more in this region, so I don't really need this. I put it in anyway, so it's a little bit of an inconsistency. But so I'll talk about more of this later. The black hole I put in would correspond to a supernova more in this regime, although I've also done one in here, so I've done two.
Yeah, so there's no supernova there.
In this case, there's not. In this case, there would be.
When you collapse the cloud, you form a star that will
Right. I mean, it does. I don't know if all of it collapses or not. I mean, I didn't do those simulations myself. I'm just sticking in a source, so I suspect some portion of it will collapse. Another portion will not, but I'm not sure. This is all being recorded while people eat here. Do I get to eat too?
You order it?
Yeah.
Get go.
But then how am I going to talk and eat at the same time?
Well, you can get a slice.
Okay, so this is maybe a good interruption because it's sort of was in between the introduction to it, the background, and now I'm actually going to start talking about the simulations that I did. So I wanted to have one slide here on the code that I'm using. I didn't write this code myself. It's quite a big piece of software. It's called Enzo. I'm sure you guys have heard about it before. This is the code that Tom Abel and his friends used to simulate the first star formation. Picture I showed earlier. It was originally written by Greg Bryan and Mike Norman, and the nice thing is it's now publicly available, so you can go to this AsterPH and that describes how to get it, how to download it, and there's some documentation and you can try to compile it and run it yourself if you have access to a parallel processing machine.
I don't know why it's called
Enzo. It's Enzo Mallorca. Bryan and Abel were looking, there was a movie a long time ago. It was 10 years ago, there was a French movie called Deep Blue, which had a competition between Enzo Mallorca, who was, he's a real character, who was at the time world champion of free immersion, and there was Jacques Mayol, who was the French guy. So the first film was called Jacques, and then when the second film came out,
it's not true. Well, Jacques is now a visualization tool that's written.
Yeah.
It comes with this. Okay, so you can get it, you can download the code and compile it and so on. Then I wanted to say a few words also about what it does. So it's very nice. It has a structured adaptive mesh refinement business, which is for you that maybe you already know about this, but what it does is, it solves the hydrodynamics on a fixed grid. But then it's not fixed because in regions where it cares, where it needs more refinement because there's, say, infalling gas or because there's a high dark matter overdensity or whatever it is, it decides to refine and place additional grids with higher resolution, finer spaced grids on top of that. And it does this in an adaptive way. So as the simulation progresses, it can detect where it needs more resolution and refine only those regions. So you basically ideally get the advantage of a very high resolution simulation, but only in the regions that you care about. And regions where there's not much going on, you don't have to waste a lot of time with a high resolution. So this is a big advantage of this code. So now the barrier and hydrodynamics are done with the piecewise parabolic method, which is a method developed by Woodward and Colella. And it's very good at capturing strong shocks, which are very common in cosmological simulations. And it uses this dual energy formalism, which basically means it has two equations of conservation for energy, one for the gas energy and one for the total energy. So in regimes where the bulk flow is very supersonic, you can still get temperature from the gas energy itself. You don't have kind of like numerical rounding error problems. The dark matter dynamics are done with an adaptive particle mesh. So the dark matter is treated, sort of sampled by individual particles, and then the gravity is calculated on a mesh by a Fourier transform. And it's adaptive because it actually uses the AMR mesh to do this Fourier transform. Then what Abel put into this code is a 9-species chemistry network. So it can track the non-equilibrium abundances of all these species of hydrogen, molecular hydrogen, and helium. And that's important because that allows you to calculate non-equilibrium cooling rates. So you would make a large mistake if you just assume that the molecular hydrogen is in equilibrium and use those equilibrium abundances and calculate cooling rates from that, you would get the wrong answer. So what you really need to do is follow the evolution, the non-equilibrium abundance of these species, and from that you calculate the cooling rates. And that's incorporated into this code. Excuse me? Yes, that's in there, in the publicly available version. And
that's right.
I have not compared a simulation. I'm not sure what the answer to that is, but I've been told that it makes a big difference. Right. Okay, so now my simulation setup, I'm using concordance cosmology, so omega matter 0.3, omega lambda 0.7, Hubble constant of 70, and the normalization of the mass matter fluctuation power spectrum is sigma 8 of 0.85, which is sort of right in the range where we believe it should lie. And the simulation I'm running is in a 1 megaparsec co-moving box, so it's very small. And I started at a redshift of 99 and run it down to a redshift of 15. So this kind of a box would actually remain linear down, somewhat further down, like maybe down to a redshift of 10, but I stop it at a redshift of 15 because I don't want to waste too much time on the process, on the computer. Okay, so then I have two-level initial conditions. So in the outer region basically I keep only sort of for a gravitational tidal field. So split this up into 128 cube grid cells and 128 cube particles, and then I refine once. So the inner region, the inner half megaparsec cubed, is refined by a factor of 2. So there's another 128 cubed grid cells here, but it's only in the inner half megaparsec. And the dark matter particles are now 1/8 of massive in this region. So you get a lot more initial resolution in here. And then, so what you have is then the dark matter particles are about 2,000 solar masses per particle, and the grid spacing here is about 4 kiloparsecs. But then on top of that, we have 6 additional levels of AMR. Now, 6 is not really all that many. When Abel and others run their simulations, they usually have 20 or even 30 additional levels. But I'm not really so much interested in zooming in on one structure that's forming, like their first star. Instead, I'm interested in sort of like a lot of structures all around here. So I decided to just go with 6, and it saves time too. And so with 6 additional AMR levels, the grid spacing in the finest, most resolved grid is 60 parsec. This in the not in the initial conditions of the dark matter. That's true. So the dark matter particle, these particles are not split up in any ways. So for the dark matter, I'm stuck with this resolution. Only for the gas, I can actually resolve the smaller details. Okay, so this is just sort of a demonstration of the power of AMR.
Could you, just to focus on that point, could
yes.
you say what the smallest mass scale in the initial conditions of fluctuations is then?
The smallest dark matter particle mass is 2,000 solar masses per particle in the inner region.
And fluctuations are not one particle. So should I multiply that by a few hundred or something?
Well, these are at a redshift of 100, so the fluctuations are very small. I'm not sure if I know how to answer your question.
The initial power spectrum.
Right.
When you put the initial conditions in,
yes.
There's a Nyquist frequency which limits the small scale structure.
Right.
And that's before you put in the AMR submesh.
Well, there is no, the AMR submesh, okay, this is the mesh I'm using for the, this is basically a mesh I'm using for the initial conditions. So it has a grid size of 4 kiloparsec, and you can use that to calculate the Nyquist.
For the
initial conditions. And then on top of that, there's AMR. Yeah, these are co-moving. Well, it's times 100. Yeah.
So in mass, the particle mass is 2,000 solar masses.
Yes.
And there's one particle per grid. So presumably that means I can see halos that are, you know, 1,000 times that, like a million solar masses. But I cannot see halos that are maybe 10,000 solar masses, because they're not, it would be 5 particles per halo. So there's a limit to what you are seeing in the way of small scale structure. Okay.
Yeah, but I do see halos
because
with...
Because when you get the barriers,
well, the baryons will do things like cool.
You mean like in the initial conditions, I can't see...
They won't be subgrids.
I mean, in the initial conditions, I don't see any halos because it's at redshift of 100.
It's under 10,000 solar masses.
And no, it's about that.
Yeah, it's 10 to the 4.
So this means that the smallest scale loss in the initial condition should be about 5 particles. You won't really see that.
Okay, I'm not sure. I mean, you'll see it later when
it's bumpiness below which you smooth it out.
But you'll see it later. I do have halos with, like, of course, eventually.
Yeah, but you want to be so reduced.
I'll talk about this in a second. I made sure that the halo I'm picking is above the Jeans math and so on. There are halos with less mass too, and I mean it. The mini quasar, I'm not resolving the mini quasar. As I'm going to explain in a minute, I'm not actually resolving the actual black hole itself. I'm resolving the halo that it sits in.
He wants to know the back reaction on the halo.
Well, I'm going to go on, and then maybe it'll become more apparent what I'm doing later. Okay, so. Yeah, this was just a demonstration of the power of AMR. So you can see here in the outer regions, it's kind of more coarse, and then the inner regions, it's more refined. And I'm just going to step through here in multiple steps, basically zooming in. And in the right, this is gas density, gas density now. The details don't really matter. I'm just assuming in through this simulation. This is, I made it so long ago, this is like at a redshift of, I think, like 17 or 18 or something, but I just wanted to show like the AMR structure here to point out that there's like large grid cells here, and in the inner region there are small grid cells. And there's one more, there's even more apparent. Okay, so now the last thing I need to talk about it before I can show some results are the radiation. So I'm assuming that only X-rays are emitted, so I have a power law that goes nu to the minus 1 from 200 eV out to 10 keV. So of course there's probably also going to be less hard radiation emitted, like UV and so on, but I don't want to have to deal with radiation transport. It's not in the code, and I don't have enough time to put it in. That would be something to do in the future. But at this point, I chose a box that is small enough that on average, it remains optically thin to this radiation. So I don't have to do the radiation transport. And since I'm only assuming the X-rays, I mean, that's going to limit what I can say about the host halo of the mini quasar itself. In the host halo, of course, there's going to be UV radiation, and you would really have to do the radiation transport in order to say anything about how the structure of the host halo itself changes. But I'm more concerned about the surrounding mini halos and just about the surrounding IGM. And so there, it's likely that the UV would not actually escape there. Okay, so what is the effect of this radiation then? Sort of an average effect that goes into the energy conservation equation and into the species abundance equation. So you have a heating term, a heating source term, and an ionization source term. And basically these are just integrals over the spectrum times the cross-section of the process that I'm considering. So now what do? I pick the earliest resolved halo. So by resolved halo, I mean something that has more than 100 dark matter particles. And it also has to be above the cosmological genes mass. So this turns out to be at a redshift of 25, a halo that has a mass of 7 times 10 to the 5 solar masses. And for reference, the baryonic genes mass here, so this is the total mass, dark matter plus baryons. So for reference, the baryonic genes mass here is 2 times 10 to the 4, so similar to what you were saying, 10,000 solar masses. So this actually is above the baryonic genes mass. So you multiply by omega baryon, you're still above this. So this means that this halo would have had enough gas. The gas would have been massive enough to collapse and form a structure like this first star, which would then explode and leave me a black hole. And then I wait some time because, as I explained, there might be a delay between the formation of this black hole and gas accreting onto it, replenishing the gas reservoir. So I wait until redshift to 21, and then I turn on a black hole. So the first simulation I ran, I chose a 500 solar mass black hole, which in retrospect I think was a little bit too massive. Maybe we should have used something a little less. So I ran another simulation with 150 solar mass black hole, but I have not had time to analyze this one yet. It's run through, but it's not analyzed. So the results I'm showing are for a 500 solar mass black hole, and that's also what this flux refers to. So the flux falls off as 1 over r squared, so I pick a location, and then I have basically a background radiation field that falls off as 1 over r squared from that point, and it has a power law nu to the minus 1. Oh, and basically I'm assuming that it's shining at Eddington luminosity. That's how I get from here to here.
So the only significance of your present mass is the luminosity?
Yes, the luminosity. Exactly. And then I let it shine for a few saltpeter times, which is about 45 mega years. And so this means it shines down to a redshift of 15, or actually 15.5. Excuse me? Yes, I chose exactly. I chose the particle that is the densest, and then that's where I stuck it. Well, I'm assuming that all of it is in X-rays. Yes, this is something we can experiment with and change the parameters. But basically, it's just an efficiency factor. Okay, so this is output. So I was kind of inspired by the plot that Paul showed last week or sometime. So this is kind of a similar thing. This is at a redshift of 21 when I first turn on the quasar. So these blobs here are mini halos that my halo finder has detected. I'm using the Hopp halo finder, which actually comes with ENSO. And the mass is color-coded here in this scale. And then the size, this is just arbitrarily chosen. The larger it is, the more massive the halo it is. So it's not actually the virial radius of the halo. I don't actually know right offhand how big these would really be. There's a range of mini halos. I think it's about 100 or so at this redshift, and this is the one that I picked. So at redshift 25, somewhat earlier than this was actually the most massive halo, but then between 25 and 21, this one actually grew to be more massive. So at this redshift, it's not the it's the third most massive halo, and this is when I turn on the radiation. And then,
could you say how in this visualization how large that box is?
Oh yeah, that's right. I should definitely say that. So this box is the inner 0.5 megaparsec that's being adaptively refined, and so the simulation actually extends out further. And you'll see in the next plot here is that what it looks like at 50.5, there's actually halos outside of the box, but I'm only showing the gas inside the box. So this is what it looks like at a redshift of 15.5. This is from a simulation without the mini quasar. So the gas, this is the baryonic gas. Oh, I forgot to also mention that this is similar to what Paul showed. This is gas at an overdensity of about 2. So 2 plus or minus 0.1 dex or something like that. And the halo is here. Now it's grown to a mass of 1.1 times 10 to the 7. This is at the end, after it's ended. It's a shining phase. Okay, and I wanted to show some movies of this. So I've run two simulations that I'm talking about here, one without radiation and one with radiation. So I have to exit out of here, good old open office. Okay, so first I'm just going to briefly show what the dark matter is doing. I mean, you've all seen dark matter simulations. These are nothing like what Anatoly does, but the time is moving down here. There's sort of a glitch in the power, in the scale, in the color scale. And now it's stopped, and now it's just sort of revolving around the box, and you can see all these individual dark matter halos that we have in this box. Again, this is only the inner 0.5 megaparsec. But you guys have seen many simulations, like many movies like this, so it's not really terribly interesting. So the next thing I was going to show is the temperature in a simulation without. This is the baryon temperature, now without the mini quasar. So it's the same thing, structures are collapsing, they're kind of heating up, but mostly it's in the range of like tens of Kelvin. I can stop this at the end. We can look at what it looks like at the end. Why are you not doing this? There. Oh, this is what I want. This is what it looks like at the end. So most of it is sort of in the tens of Kelvin, and then of course where the halos are, it's hotter. It goes into like hundreds and thousands of degrees Kelvin. So now I'm also going to show a movie of, the same simulation with the mini quasar in it. Now this is going to be sort of hard to visualize. I sort of had a hard time making this movie because there's such a larger scale in temperatures, and so when I first show it, you won't really be able to see much before the mini quasar turns on, because later on I want to capture what's happening after the mini quasar turns on. So this is the same sort of idea. You can see it's very faint and fuzzy, but then at some point the mini quasar turns on and it pretty much immediately blasts the whole box to 10 to the 4. It's sort of hard to visualize. There's definitely still structure there. It's just kind of hard to visualize it.
Why is there a time
difference? First of all, I do put in, well, it's this heating. It just takes more time for the longer time you have.
So
right, but still, but it's
the same flux.
Right, but the longer you expose a gas amount to the flux.
You're seeing the 1/r² difference in flux, and so it takes longer to heat.
Yes, that's what you see. Yeah, there's no radiation transport. There's no time dependence other than that. Okay. All right. So back to the. No, I have done that. It doesn't matter. That actually is in the simulation, but it doesn't make it. Doesn't make a difference.
Just because, given that the light travel time is so short, every atom is going to be blasted at the same time.
This is with a different flux.
I would have thought that the heating up time, though, is so short.
Yeah, it's millions of years.
You instantly reach a different temperature, a different rate.
You see this here. So this is the two simulations. Now these are just slices through the box, through the location of the mini quasar. On the left, I'll show several slides like this. On the left is the one without radiation, on the right with radiation. So this is the gas temperature. Without it, you see it's like all sort of tens of degrees Kelvin in the halo, it goes higher. Oh, I should also say this is again only the inner 0.5 megaparsecs. And I'm using a visualization program written by Nick Nadine. It's called IFRIT, which is also publicly available, but it can only take uniform spaced grids to visualize it. And since I have an AMR simulation, I can't actually take advantage of my AMR levels for visualizing it. So I'm only used the 0th and 1 first AMR level. That's why this all sort of looks fuzzy. If I actually was showing all the AMR levels, this would be like a nice resolved structure. Okay, so then compare.
What is the time for that? You captured it.
Yeah,
this wonderful transient.
Right.
So how
this
how
is very,
since the source turned on?
The source turned on is equal 21, so that's like a few,
really
very short amount of time. That's only like, I think, 5 or or maybe 10 million years or something like that. Not very long, maybe a little longer, maybe 28 million years.
This is called secondary X-ray.
secondary heating is included in here. That's true. So you're right. If I look at this at the end of the simulation, the whole box is more or less sort of whitish red. I mean, you can still see a little bit of it. Gradient, but it's mostly gone. So anyways, the whole box is kind of heated to 10 to the 4 degrees. That's like the upshot of this in a very short amount of time. Now let's look at the ionization. So you need to have two different color scales here, because on the left, everything is pretty much neutral. I mean, you have the most ionized it gets is like sort of 10 to the 4 degree, 10 to the minus 4. This is a electron number density over total hydrogen number density. And then on the right, you see with the mini quasar, this is now at the end of the simulation, at redshift 15.5. The inner regions here are ionized at about 40%, but even the outer regions are ionized at about 10%. So what we get is that we have a box that's very hot, 10 to the 4 Kelvin, but it's ionized at about a 10% level or so, kind of average throughout the box. And so that has implications for like redshifted 21 centimeter observations or so, because you have hot gas, which is still, to a large degree, neutral. One more. Okay, and this is basically the gene smoothing that you get out of this. Here you see there's structures without radiation, there's baryonic structures that are kind of collapsing that you could envision would form subsequent stars and maybe galaxies and so on. Here on the right, however, the radiation has heated it and therefore raised the gene's mass until you end up with these fuzzy blobs. It can't really collapse and form small structures. Gas distribution is puffed up. Okay, and then now, shifting gears, I also made phase diagrams. So these are plots where on the right I have the density over the background density, and on the right the temperature. And these are basically two-dimensional histograms, except I've colored them. So they tell you what volume fraction is at a given temperature and density. And so this is at a redshift of 15.5, right? And so at the end of my simulation, and this is from a simulation without the mini quasar, and I'll show you the one with the mini quasar right after this. But there's a few structures that I wanted to point out. So down here you can see an adiabat, which is basically just the entropy is proportional to rho to the minus 2/3 times T, which is constant for an adiabat, and that's basically just the initial condition. I have a movie that I can show you of this later. So this is basically a gas that has been unaffected by shocks or by anything else. And then there's this gas, however, shock heated. So it's gone away from the adiabat towards higher temperatures. And you can see like a little bit of a cooling tail out here. And then this was for the case without the mini quasar. So when I put the mini quasar in there, it looks drastically different. Now I have the gas has been heated by this radiation field to 10 to the 3, 10 to the 4 degrees Kelvin. And then I have this nice cooling tail, which is due to the molecular hydrogen. And then I should just point out for consistency, there's this little feature here. There's another adiabat, but that's an artificial effect of a parameter that I mistakenly turned on in my simulation, sort of providing a minimum pressure for all the grids that are more refined. And I've now run a simulation that are most refined. But I've now run a simulation without this, and this just goes away. So it's just an artifact. This?
Yeah.
I am not sure.
Although in the gas is fine.
To the right. So the way I view this is that like all the gas is just heated up to above here, and then it immediately cools down via just atomic cooling down to here, and then here it just sits for a while, and then it slowly cools down like this. But I can't exactly answer what exactly is causing this spike. I mean, I assume it's maybe just from the gas that happened to be here and then was heated by the radiation to lie up there, and it just cooled straight down.
Maybe the time dependent on provide some
information. Yes, that's true.
Could you compare that
to the one
before you
hit
the mini quasar?
Okay, actually,
it cooled anymore.
What I'm going to show you is a movie of these starting at a redshift of 25, and it's going to be on the left without the mini quasar, on the right with the mini quasar. So, and they should be more or less synchronized. So you can see, so unfortunately these are with this stupid minimum pressure support, so they still have this kind of artificial feature, so it extends a little further.
It is cooling further.
Yes.
With the help of the X-ray.
Because the formation of
the X-ray is the ionization level.
Yeah. But that's but this is a little bit unfair because you might actually have a Lyman-Werner H2 dissociating flux in there, which I have not included in the simulation. So I wouldn't want to say anything about the effect on the molecules right now. Yeah, there's. So. Okay. And so, but I don't think this really answers what this feature is from. I mean, it seems like it was always there from the very beginning. Maybe this gas just gets heated up there. More to learn and understand. Okay, so that just brings me to my conclusions. An early population of mini quasars would have a serious impact on the surrounding small halos and on the IGM that's surrounding it in general. The IGM is just heated to 10 to the 4 degrees Kelvin. And the ionization fraction is small, as I pointed out, but it's hot, so you might be able to see it in emission against the CMB in redshift to 21 centimeter. And then the gas collapse in neighboring halos is definitely delayed because it's heated and its genes mass has been raised. And what I want to still do with this, I want to look in detail at how the baryonic halo mass function is affected. So I can make mass functions before or with and without the mini quasar and see how it affects this. And then also, I would like to run a simulation in which I take the host halo just to make it more realistic and kind of pre-process it to add some kind of radiation effects from the supernova and its progenitor to like ionize the host halo. And then also possibly include a simulation, or have a simulation where I include Lyman-Werner H2 dissociating flux also falling off as one of R squared or some other method. That's it.